This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
The thing I wanted to talk about is this issue that everyone's been discussing of chain migration.
Mm-hmm.
And not so much the concept itself, although you kind of need that for background, but the way that social scientists have been discussing it, although it's also interesting how politicians have been discussing it. So immigration restrictionist side has taken up this term of chain migration and used it more or less as a synonym for family reunification visas.
Mm-hmm.
Especially extended kin. Nobody's proposing to get rid of visas for minor children and spouses, but you do have a lot of people who want to reduce visas for, you know, adult siblings, parents, that sort of thing. And
Donald Trump made that point last night.
Well, it doesn't surprise me because it's a very consistent argument for, and you very often hear this among the restrictionists referred to as end chain migration. But, you know, and so kind of in reaction to this, you see, a lot of people on the left taking up this position of, oh, chain migration is this horrible term and nobody should use it. And including in that is you see a lot of social scientists saying that. So like Russell Sage Foundation had this tweet today. We're recording this on Wednesday the 31st, talking about an op-ed that a scholar associated with them had put out saying that chain migration is part of this like term of rhetoric. And this actually is part of this guy's expertise. But, people have pointed out before is that the term chain migration was not invented by immigration restrictionists 2 years ago. It was invented, right? It was a term coined by immigration scholars in the mid 20th century. And all of us learned it in grad school, right? I mean, we studied with Doug Massey and Alex Portes, especially Doug Massey. And fundamentally, that's what Doug Massey does, right? He studies chain migration. I do think it's fair to point out that if you want to point out that there's various good things about chain migration, great, go ahead and do so. I was talking to Kieran Healy and he said that he pointed out that traditionally this was seen as like a source of social cohesion.
Mm-hmm.
Good point, right? Point that out. And then likewise, I think it's also well worth pointing out that the term has gotten changed in its political usage. So in its original scholarly usage, the term meant any migration that is made more likely because of social networks. And whereas in its current political usage, it means family reunification visas. And that is a difference because you can have, I think it's fair to say that family reunification visas are a subset of chain migration. Almost by definition, they have to involve chain migration, but chain migration can involve a lot more than that. So if I leave UCLA and go to the University of Toronto, and then the next week I call my brother and say, man, Toronto's the greatest city in North America. You'd love it here. You should come there. Mm-hmm. Canada doesn't have visas for me to sponsor you as an adult sibling, but they do have skill-based visas based on points. And you speak English, you're a college graduate, you're middle age. So apply, and I think you have enough points that you could get into Canada on the skill-based system. That would still be chain migration, even though it doesn't involve a family visa, because my brother migrating to Canada would be made more likely by me migrating to Canada. So in the scholarly usage, there is a difference. I think it is fair to say that family reunification visas are a subset, and I think it would be entirely fair for people to point that out, and I have pointed that out. But what drives me fucking crazy is people who ought to know better, acting as if this is this horrible slur that was used yesterday, that was invented yesterday, and forgetting that, this is a term that they've used themselves in its original meaning. So like Russell, with Russell Sage, I checked, they published 12 books about chain migration.
Well, you know what? So here's the thing. I'm going to kind of push back on that a little bit.
Yeah, because, that's cool.
Only because I actually think the reason why they're acting like this, that the chain migration, that term is a slur, is because it is being used as kind of a slur. right? And it's not, yeah. And it's like when we use it, we're using it to actually describe, right, this certain pattern of migration from one place to another, right, that relies on, sure. on social, on basically, you know, social networks, right?
Sure.
Most of those networks are generally not familial, or at least not, you know, not your parents and your kids and whatever, but like, you know, they're people from your hometown, your friends, your neighbors, et cetera, right?
I tried to clarify the original scholarly usage, but you're exactly right. It doesn't just refer to kin. It also refers to neighbors.
Yeah. And so now, like, basically what, like with this sort of like, you know, political sleight of hand, basically there is kind, I think there is a conflation because, you know, because family reunification could be thought of as a subset of chain migration, I guess, if you're mm-hmm. thinking that people are, you know, are sponsoring their second cousins and their cousins and blah, 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 blah. But very often when people sponsor their relatives, right, it's usually because those relatives also help to support them and the work that they're doing here. Like I remember in grad school, mm-hmm. you know, living over there in Butler. Is that where we
yeah.
lived? Yeah, in Butler.
Yeah,
I was like, Butler. Is that what it was called? Living yeah. in Butler. I mean, there were quite a few of my neighbors were Chinese grad students. And you know, and there would be and they were couples, right? And they would have their first baby. And then, and because they both worked in labs, it was really necessary. I mean, how else are you going to pay for childcare, right? Yeah. When you're living in Butler, right?
And those of you who didn't go to grad school at Princeton in the early aughts, you should have seen the gardens these Chinese grandparents made. I mean, they would build like lattices.
Yep.
And then they would have like things growing. They'd have a two-story garden. I don't know how that's possible, yep. but they built like lattices, and then they'd have things growing on top of the garden on the lattice.
Yeah, it was crazy. And so, number one, like family unification, I think number one serves to help support immigrants who were here because of skills, right? Or because sure. they have a job, mm-hmm. help support them in the work that they do to be these like effective, efficient, productive citizens or citizens to be of this country. And number two, it also helps to ensure, I think, that those migrants think of their status here as permanent, right? Because I always thought that one of the things that we thought we should be striving for in our immigration policy is that the immigrants who come here, quote unquote, assimilate, right? And mm-hmm. will eventually become citizens, right? And, you know, one of the ways to help ensure that that happens is if they have their family here with them, right? So there are mm-hmm. actually these incredibly beneficial reasons for promoting family unification.
Wait, is that actually true empirically that, you know, having kin in, you know, with you would help you assimilate? Because I kind of feel like, I mean, spousal visas aren't, nobody's really challenging those, but you would imagine that outmarriage would be a huge contributor to assimilation.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. So, you know, I think about the situation of the Chinese, right, in the 19th mm-hmm. century.
Sure.
And there were just dudes here, right?
Uh-huh.
And whatever. And they were like, you know, we are no longer able to naturalize, right? We aren't supposed to, there are prohibitions against us being with white women, right? I mean, mm-hmm. there were pockets of Chinese men who formed households with black women, right? In the South in particular, for a time because, you know, because they didn't have any other women. Mm-hmm. But the vast majority of them, because of that, because they weren't able to naturalize, they weren't able to bring families over with them, just thought of themselves as, okay, we're just going to work here. We're going to try and save money and then we're going to leave. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what most of them, that was the plan that most of them had. Now, once immigration laws changed to then allow, you know, Asians to naturalize, right, and also to bring their family over, more and more we actually saw Asian communities actually becoming more part of the fabric of American life and less, you know, totally removed in their own ethnic enclaves, right? Partly because, you know, at that point in time, there was also civil rights legislation that helped to open up opportunities to them.
Well, listen, I mean, everything you're saying is, and I think that's a very good point that, you know, when you allow kinship-based migration, you know, that this facilitates, you know, long-term roots. And, you know, at first it's going to create an ethnic enclave, but then in the long run, it'll probably create assimilation. Mm-hmm. Whereas the alternative is realistically circular migration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but, you know, putting that aside, everything you're saying is an argument for why family reunification is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with people arguing that, right? And I wish that's what, you know, social scientists who favor family reunification were arguing. I wish they were basically making an argument on the merits instead of just saying this term is an illegitimate term when we're the ones who coined it, right? It's insulting, right? And it's like, right. Yeah. And also, like, I've heard people say, like, well, the term meant something when we used it, and now it means something different when they use it. But they don't even mean it in the sense of, like, I was clarifying that it's a more generic process. It doesn't refer to a specific category of visa. Mm-hmm. It refers to a generic pattern of behavior, regardless of the type of visa. And this is why the restrictive slogan, end chain migration, is absurd. Because even if we had 100% skill-based system, we would still have chain migration.
Yes. Sir.
We have less of it, but we would still have chain migration. It would, you know, just because, you know, let's say it's all H-1Bs, I get an H-1B, I tell my lawyer, this is the recruiter I worked with, this is what they want to see on your file, and then that makes it more likely, you know, to have chain migration. I have a colleague who studies, it's not H-1B, it's whatever the equivalent is for lower skilled workers. And, you know, that involves a ton of chain migration, even though it's a work program, not a family reunification program.
Yeah.
In the technical sense. Yeah. Anyway, but my point is, you know, just don't piss on my leg and tell me it's raining, right? Don't act like, you know, this is like an illegitimate term. And if you want to say, well, it's the way it's used in that it's becomes associated with all these other terms, effectively, you're just saying, I don't like that perspective,
mm-hmm.
right? It's not really a problem with the term per se. It's just saying, I don't like this political platform, the people who advocate it, whatever. And that's fine. But then you don't really have a problem with the term. You have a problem with the perspective.
So basically, from this conversation, like, I can envision that one of the unintended effects of ending quote unquote chain migration and turning this into sort of a skill-based immigration system is you would still have chain migration, but it would be a lot harder for immigrants who were here to actually have family members here to help support them, right? And to be as effective as they've been in the past because they've had their moms come and take care of their kids. They've had their dads come and help them, you know, take care of the kids and help them fix the car and you know, and build the house.
It would be Canada. Uh-huh. And my understanding is that, you know, Canada's policy is basically to have a huge amount of skill-based migration and minimal family reunification immigration. And my understanding is that Canadian migrants, you know, who are brought in from their own skills, sometimes, you know, they wish that they could bring their parents in to help watch the grandkids and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. I think, but the difference,
you know, that's not the Canadian system.
But the difference is the Canadian system has a much more generous social safety net, right?
But not for childcare, though. Which and that's a pretty compelling argument. But you know, Gabe, there are sometimes. What about that argument, though? That like the meaning has changed, like. I'm searching my mind for words that were neutral that became sort of epithets with the
time moved on. And it's my banter. It's my banter. What? It's gentrification. Great segue.
Hey, well, wait. Let's get. Hold on. Let's do it a moment.
No, we don't need it. We don't need the guitar. You know, here I'll do it. Do. Okay, now Leslie, tell us about gentrification.
Go, right? Leslie. Go.
All right. So, you know, I'm not a gentrification scholar, and so, you know, those of you who are listening out there who are, right, you know what I mean. If you want to blast me on this, go ahead. But my understanding of the word gentrification, right? I mean, so. The literature on gentrification comes from the UK, right? And it comes from research that basically looked at neighborhoods that were inhabited by working class families, and noted the ways in which lower middle and middle and upper middle class families and individuals started moving into those working class neighborhoods. And basically over time, because, you know, rent and, you know, and the cost of owning your home became so expensive, displacing those working class inhabitants, right? The word gentrification has at its root the word gentry, right? So it's all, it's very, very class specific, right? Fast forward from the 1960s to the 1990s here in the United States, when we use the word gentrification, it's about neighborhood change, right? But very often, even though we understand that there was a class component to it, because of course we're here in the United States, you know, the only thing we actually really seem to see is race, right? So race is the primary component. That's how we know a neighborhood is gentrifying, right? Is that white people show up in a place that previously had almost only Black and or Latino residents, right? So there's that. And now I was reading this piece in the New York Times Magazine on Sunday that basically says that now gentrification isn't just about neighborhoods anymore, but it's being used to describe everything from mobile homes to sandwiches, right? So how can a sandwich become gentrified, right? That's
well, it has aioli instead of mayonnaise.
Right? And so, I mean, I just want to, so I want to read just a little bit of this piece for you. It says, blah, blah, blah. What do I think is great? A recent article in the New Republic by Sarah Jones connected tiny houses to two other lifestyle trends, raw water, unfiltered drinking water, and hashtag van life, living in a van, but on Instagram. Those who collect their drinking water, Jones writes, have adopted a hardship that poor people suffer and stripped it of its association with poverty. She adds, raw water is a way of gentrifying that poverty. Right? I found that to be fascinating. The poor are still gentrification's victims, but in this new meaning, the harm is not rent increases and displacement. It's something psychic, a theft of pride, right? And the phenomena it describes seems inescapable, but there's something in this new usage that obfuscates as much as it reveals, lending cover to the much larger forces that shape our lives. Minority communities are being dismantled as macroeconomic winds transform urban America. Researchers are now concerned that the high cost of housing is a drag on our whole economy, with young people either trapped or spending too much on rent or fleeing overheated urban markets, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Some of them are now living in vans, right? And so I found this to be a very, very fascinating move, right, in the use of the term gentrification, right? I felt as though for a very long time when people wrote about or we read about gentrification, right, it all had to do with the material. It all had to do with rents. It all had to do with space. It all had to do with displacement, right? And now there's this use of the word gentrification that in many ways doesn't even talk about that at all, but it's all about, it seems like, I know we don't like to use this term in sociology, but it's all about cultural appropriation.
It's like conceptual inflation. It's very similar to Gabriel's topic, right? You have a very specific concept, has a very specific meaning, and then just everybody sort of slaps their latest story idea or blog post idea. They slap the concept onto it to make it feel current.
Yeah.
And it loses meaning, like neoliberalism or.
Yeah, I'm just struck by, you said, like, I know we don't like to talk about this in sociology, but cultural appropriation, because that's the kind of thing that you're totally right. But if you asked anybody on the street, what do sociologists talk about? They probably think we do. It's like people don't understand that, like, no, that's for, like, you know, there's some crank at the School of Education who talks like that. But, you know, sociologists are all about, like, you know, how do we get the standard error right in our regression, you know?
Are you sure about that? Let's just put a bookmark on that.
I'm sure with enough work, I could find some sociologist who's, you know.
Well, I think there's an elite culture and sort of a more pop culture within the discipline.
Oh, that's true. I agree.
You know, and maybe you don't see it at the top 50 or so schools, but there's, how many departments are there in the country? There's probably 1,000, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But anyhow, I didn't mean to detain you on your point.
No, but I mean, taking it seriously, right? I think that Leslie has a point that it's not just about housing prices. It's also about, you know, kind of cultural amenities that make neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite documentaries, which unfortunately is impossible to find, so I feel weird about recommending it, is called People Like Us.
Uh-huh. I own it.
Oh, great. Okay, so Leslie will be able to enjoy this. Everybody else will just have to either know me or Leslie and be able to borrow a copy. So this is a documentary that was on PBS around 2004, maybe a little earlier. And, you know, they went through it. It's like just talking about class culture. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely fascinating because you see, like, what people really get mad about is kind of social class taste markers, like cultural capital fundamentally is what people talk about. And so there's this, like the first segment is about, I think it's Burlington, Vermont, it's some town in Vermont. And they're trying to decide, like the grocery store closes and they're trying to decide what, whether they should give the license to the Shaws, which is kind of the New England version of Ralph's or Piggly Wiggly or whatever. And, or if they should give it to, and I'm not making this up, the Onion River Food Co-op. Uh-huh. And so they're trying to decide whether to, you know, I have no idea why this was a political decision and not just who offered the landlord the most lease, but the city council decided to give it the, you know, the space to the Onion River Food Co-op. And so you have all the working class people in there talking about, like, they don't want to eat a bunch of tofu. And mm-hmm. and they just feel like socially excluded from, you know, this organic food co-op type place. And so it was just like this great illustration of how contestations about place and neighborhood and whatever are very often about kind of cultural capital and people feeling that they don't belong or aren't welcome because the amenities that are available are the kind of things that they feel are designed and intended for people other than
Well, that. You know what? So I think that that's part of the story where it comes to where culture comes in, but there's the other part where people come in, right? And they see, right, that you have this chopped cheese sandwich in your bodega, which costs $4, right? And they're like, you know what? Let's open up a Whole Foods and let's have a version of your chopped cheese from the bodega in Whole Foods for $8, right? And meanwhile, your bodega is priced out of the market. And so if you want to chop cheese, you got to make it yourself or you got to go to the Whole Foods because that's now the only game in town. So you took my thing, right? You took my thing. You made it impossible for me to provide it in my space, right? And now you have it and it's twice as expensive, right?
What the hell is chopped cheese?
Well, it's like ground. It's like a sandwich with like ground beef with cheese melted on top of it.
I've never heard of this. I don't know if it's because I'm upper middle class or because I'm from California.
No, it's
or
a Bronx. It's a New York thing. It's like a Bronx. It's a Bronx bodega thing.
Yeah, I didn't remember if it was B-side or ours, but there was one of our episodes when you know, you said something about somebody being online. Uh-huh. And not to refer to the internet, but to refer to, like, you know, waiting online at the deli. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Leslie's a New Yorker. You know?
I'm a New Yorker. Yeah. Yeah. So, I think those are things, I think these are things that I'd like to see a little bit more merged together. Right. I mean, there are costs to gentrification, right. That aren't that aren't just material, right? They're psychic, mm-hmm. right? And can, you know, can we see more work that deals with both, right? Or that understands that both things happen at once. So much of, I feel like so much of what I see that has to do with culture and gentrification talks about how gentrifiers create culture in those spaces, right? As though those spaces were devoid of culture to begin with, number one. And number two, as though gentrifiers didn't inhabit those spaces in part because of the culture that existed there, right? And whatever culture may be coming out of or emerging from these spaces once we have this demographic change, right? It's at least in part informed by the culture that was there before the gentrifiers came.
Yeah, it's funny that you talk about like this, you know, more dominant literature on like gentrifiers creating culture, because like this whole literature on like how arts build communities, and you know that like art galleries are like a leading indicator of rising neighborhood values. Mm-hmm. That's basically just a positive interpretation of the same yep. issue.
If only we had, cool. if only we had an urban sociologist here today.
Yeah. Yeah. If only.
Get your flu shots, people.
Yeah. Yeah, get your flu shots. I had that flu. Oh, no. It was awful.
Yeah.
So, Gabe.
But we're looking forward to her being yes. on. We're not, not that she's not here. We're looking forward to it.
No, no. We're genuinely concerned. Yeah. It's just a podcast.
Well, it's the flu. I mean, she doesn't have consumption.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.